Well, okay, so I'm going to talk to you today about electromagnetic precursors of binary supermassive black hole mergers. This is some work that I've done while I was in Berkeley in collaboration with people at Berkeley and Christian Manu at Columbia. Let me first give you a brief outline of my talk. I'm going to talk first about gravitational waves. This is a gravitational wave group after all, or strong gravity group, and binary black holes. And I'm going to give a little bit of motivation, why we need electromagnetic counterparts to binary black hole mergers to learn something about the astrophysics of the situation. Right? And in order to discuss this, we're going to talk about all the different stages of supermassive binary black hole mergers. Right? All the way from basically the initial merger of two galaxies, the in-spiral of two binary black holes, the final parsec problem, and the final merger. Okay? And we'll talk about different electromagnetic counterparts that can emerge from all these different stages. Right? And these electromagnetic counterparts can tell us, inform us much about basically the rates and the astrophysics of these of black hole mergers. Then I'm going to talk about some work I did with collaboration with Linda Stroop, who's a student at Berkeley, Kristen Manoa at LA Quarter, on the electromagnetic precursor. Right? Most of the work that's been done on electromagnetic counterparts thus far has been focused on stuff that happens after the fact, after the merger has happened. But I'm going to talk about something that can happen just slightly before, and we'll talk a little about problems and prospects for the future. Right. So the other thing I want to say is that I welcome interruptions because that's just the way I do things. I tend to think better on my feet, but that being said, hopefully I won't stumble and then crash. Right. So first,
should get you off your feet now.
What? Yeah. Yes. Yes. All right. So sweep me off my feet. Okay. So gravitational waves. All right. So Einstein's equations linearize emit wave solutions. This is something everyone's known for a long time, but so thus far there's only been indirect evidence for gravitational waves. Right? Namely, the best evidence from this pulsar, J0737-3030. Okay? But the most famous example, and the one that won the Nobel Prize, the Hirson-Taylor pulsar, PSR B1913+16. And you can see here, basically, this is the shift of the periastron time as a function of time. And this is the general relativity prediction. And this is off by something like 0.02%. Right? Indirect evidence for gravitational waves, and thus far has been, I think, the best evidence. Well, aside from this other binary pulsar right here.
What do you mean that the tighter one is the best? You mean that it's
So this one is a tighter binary, and so it has a larger shift. So even though it's only been discovered for at least, I think, maybe 2004 or something like that. So there's a larger shift in perihelion for this particular job. So even though it's only been discovered not too long ago, the evidence from this one is actually already much stronger. So this one actually turns out to be a very important system because it shifts so much that you can actually start to learn something about basically the moment of inertia of the two neutron stars. So in fact, when we talk about equation of states for neutron stars, this one may be advanced LIGO to the punch, all right? At least for 1.2 solar mass neutron stars.
And I think that's the one where also the beach gravity probe and frame gravity is one that when it came out, you could have thrown out gravity probe.
Yeah.
Well, it's thrown out anyway.
Well, you could have thrown out gravity probe.
By the way, you mean gravity
probe. Oh, that's, oh. Wait, okay. I'll be quiet now. Okay, so I'm going to talk about some sources of gravitational waves. So there are two sources of gravitational waves. First is fundamental physics, right? Inflation, cosmic strains, brain world scenarios. I don't really know much about this sort of thing. I do know a lot more about astrophysics, right? And in astrophysics, the dominant source of gravitational waves are basically where you have large amounts of mass moving at very large velocities, right? So that means basically compact object mergers, neutron star mergers, neutron star black hole mergers, black hole mergers, supernova explosion, when you have a collapse of an iron core to basically a proto-neutron star, all right? Galactic binaries, all right? White dwarf neutron star binaries or white dwarf binaries, okay? Binary supermassive black holes, when you have two black holes of order 10 to the 6 solar masses or larger, basically orbiting each other, and extreme mass ratio in spirals, right? Basically, small stellar mass black holes or small stellar mass objects orbiting much, much larger black holes in the centers of galaxies. Okay, so this is a major effort, basically, in terms of detecting gravitational waves. From the ground, we have LIGO, Virgo, and GEO. And toward the future, we have basically a space experiment named LISA, Laser Interferometric Space Antenna. And these guys are after very, very different regimes, right? So this is, of course, everyone's seen the LIGO sensitivity curve. And one can see, basically, that the frequencies of interest are anywhere from about 40 hertz up to about maybe 1,000 hertz or so. And so these guys are very interested in black holes, right, which are about maybe 1 to 10, 100 solar masses or so, maybe compact objects, which are about 1 to 100 solar masses. Whereas LISA's sensitivity curve is anywhere from about a thousandth of a hertz, maybe a hundredth of a hertz, maybe a little few hundreds of a hertz. And these guys are more interested in basically 10 to the 4 to 10 to the 7 solar mass black holes. So they're after very, very different regimes. And today I'm going to really focus basically on what the what LISA will...
Remind me again, what... I know for the LIGO, it's seismic is the wall of one end,
yes,
photon shot noise,
yep,
of the other.
Yep.
What's the wall for LISA?
This, so this here is galactic binaries. All right. So toward the low frequency end, you have a lot of white dwarf binaries, and they have, and because there are so many of them, it generates. Yeah, I mean, like, it's not really seismic analog. Astronomers are actually interested in this. In this regime, basically, because it tells you something about if you pick out each one of them, then you can learn something about basically the evolution of these systems, how many systems there are out there. So it tells you something. It gives constraints on binary synthesis and stellar populations.
So you're saying you're not an astronomer
because
you said astronomers are interested.
Are interested.
Yeah, but he means you're not one
because that's your noise, right?
Oh yeah. Well, okay. So it depends on what kind of astronomer you are. If you're interested in binary synthesis, then yes.
So then how firmly is that wall known? Like, is there flexibility in its slope? Is it like this one seismic? I think.
Right. Yes. That one you can measure.
Yeah.
This one I think comes from observations in binary synthesis models. So this is model dependent. But I'm not sure how much play you have on that low end side. I mean, Lathan, you might know a little more about this.
So I think the actual curve there is an actual experiment. Their actual experimental sensitivity also goes down at frequencies longward of the time travel time between the two satellites. So, but then it is true that at sufficiently at frequencies below like 10 to the minus 3 hertz,
yeah,
that above that is a background of white dwarfs. And that, if you look shortward of 10 to the minus 3 hertz, so in other words, higher frequencies, then you can do what Phil said, which is separate them all out.
Right.
There's sufficiently few of them that you can separate them out and study, learn something about them individually. But below 10 to the minus 3 hertz, they really are more or less a noise source in the sense that they merge into a stochastic background that there's so many of them you can't separate them.
Okay.
So there you can still learn something like what is the total number.
Total number,
and
right.
What is the, some rough thing about what is their distribution in the sky. But
I know this distracts from your main event.
Yes. All right.
Sorry about that.
No, don't apologize. I welcome interruption. Okay. So what can you learn from binary black hole mergers just from gravitational waves, just from these two detectors like LIGO and LISA? Well, you can learn something about the mass, learn about the spin, these guys, hopefully. You can learn about the distance because these gravitational waves are a standard siren, as Scott Hughes likes to call them. All right. You can learn about the population dynamics of black holes. Measuring the number of black hole mergers tells you but the rate at which this happens. All right? Tells you something about maybe galactic galaxy formation. You measure orbital parameters, all right? And if you're very good, you might learn something about strong field GR as well. Okay? But there's a problem, right? And the problem is that if you ask where it happened, okay, well, the best you can constrain it to is maybe tens of arc minutes to maybe 100 arc minutes or so. So you have no localization in the sky. You look at that patch of sky, you will guess anywhere from like a million to 10 million galaxies, right? You could try to cut it down by saying, okay, well, I can roughly get what the redshifts of all these guys are, And I roughly know what the distance is, so I can basically put a cut on that. But you still get many, 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 many galaxies, right? So what you really want is you want electromagnetic counterparts associated with the event, right? And for every merger, if you could find one counterpart, right, then you could learn something about instantly about the host galaxy. It tells you where, which kind of, what kind of galaxies do these things occur in, okay? If you get the host galaxy, you can measure redshift. That gives you a, because you know the luminosity distance, this teaches you something about dark energy, tells you something about cosmology, right? You could learn about the merger physics because the character of the electromagnetic counterpart tells you much about basically what processes drove it to merge, right? And because if you get any electromagnetic counterpart, it inevitably involves gas because you need a dissipative source. You learn something about basically the gas disk dynamics and the accretion physics, right? If you don't learn something about this, it also tells you something, informs you much about basically the nuclear dynamics near galaxies. Namely, what's the rate at which stars are scattered, or what's the rate at which stars basically migrate through their phase space, all right? And finally, you can learn something about the growth of supermassive black holes. Namely, basically from the gas disk dynamics. All right. Okay, so what are the possible electromagnetic counterparts that you can see from binary black holes, right? So to try to basically understand what the possibilities is, now all this is very speculative. To understand what the possibilities are, we have to understand the stages of mergers of two supermassive black holes. Okay, so the first thing is that where are supermassive black holes? They're the nuclei of galaxies. How do you get two black holes to merge? You have to take two galaxies and smash them together, right? So the first stage of supermassive black hole mergers is you have a galaxy merge. So this is basically a beautiful picture of ARP-227. We see two spiral galaxies basically colliding with each other, all right? And within these two spiral galaxies, in the nuclei of these two spiral galaxies, there is a supermassive black hole. No evidence of multiple supermassive black holes, right? And then basically you move.
Do you mean there's one in each?
There's one. Okay, so
one shared between.
There's one in each.
One in each.
One in each. There's no evidence. So there is some evidence that for certain galaxies there's no black holes in the center, but there's zero evidence that in any galaxy there are two black holes in the nuclei.
But there is empirical evidence that each of these guys have one.
For these guys, I believe, yes. Okay. Yes. All right.
Gas rotation curves?
That is from, usually from, this is the same stuff that, Gephardt and company do, basically look at the stellar dynamics toward the center, look at the velocity dispersion, and try to basically ask how big of a dark object to put there in order to fit the velocity.
Yes.
Most of the measures are from stars. You can also do it from gas as well, but I don't think 272 is a active galaxy or anything like that. So I think it's mostly from stars. Okay. All right. So the other possibility is you basically can see during the in-spiral phase. Now this is actually a quite remarkable result. Okay. This is NGC 6240, right? And this is a Chandra image of it. And what you see is you see two bright spots. And the separation between these two bright spots is about 1.7 kiloparsecs, right? Projected in the sky. Okay. And these two bright spots are thought to be associated with two supermassive black holes, which are basically in the process of merging. So this has gone way past where you have galaxies merge, which are the mergers are happening on something like tens of KPC, tens of kiloparsecs, right? Down to basically a region where you're looking at stuff at few kiloparsecs or so, right? And these two guys are basically moving around each other, and they're going to basically scatter stars out from their system and basically fall closer and closer toward each other. Okay. Now, in order to have this process happen, it's known as a process known as dynamic friction. And just to give a brief aside on what dynamic friction is, basically, if you have a massive object moving in the background of less massive objects, right, and this object is moving forward at velocity v, basically, it sees this background of particles moving past it with velocity of minus v. Right? Now, if I take these particles and I deflect them, basically, the characteristic change per particle is something like m times v, right? Character change in the momentum. Okay? So if I want to change the total momentum of this guy, I better deflect a total mass of background particles of roughly m. Okay, if each of these little particles is little m, I better deflect basically a total mass of big M, basically, in order to change the momentum of this large object. Okay, and so what this means is that for any orbiting black hole, all right, that is basically in a galactic nuclei, I have to deflect roughly my own mass and stars to get one E folding, reduction in my radius, right? And this is an interesting problem because toward the center of the galaxies are roughly something like isothermal potentials. The density goes like 1 over r squared, right, which means the mass goes like r. Right? So toward some radius, I just don't have enough stars anymore. I just cannot deflect sufficient number of stars in order for these supermassive black holes to sink. And this is known as the hang-up or the final parsec problem. Basically, if you ask the question, at what radius do I have insufficient stars in order for a black hole to basically merge, right? That turns out to be anywhere from about 0.1 parsec out to about maybe 1 parsec, maybe up to a few parsecs or so, okay? And I ask the second question, which is, at what radius can I have two black holes coalesce in less than a Hubble time? Then you basically get a factor of 30 to 100 smaller, all right? So I need to get from here to here in order for basically my black holes to merge, and this is known as the final parsec problem simply because the stalling radius at which black holes stop is something like of order a parsec or so, okay?
So this means about that these guys will just sort of...
They're just going to rotate around.
They have no incentive
to go any closer, and so basically if you look at sufficient number of these of galaxies, all right, well, if independent of any other process, when you have galactic mergers, then you will always only get a binary black hole. And so if you look at a bunch of galaxies, what you should expect to see is like all these galaxies have binary black holes around them. Right, and
No one sees any.
There's no evidence for any binary black holes at all.
Are there systems where if there are one or two?
Not a close separation.
Not at the parsec.
Not at the parsec, yeah.
If they were,
how close are they?
Kiloparsec scale, yeah.
But then why do you call them binary?
If there were binaries at the centers of every galaxy,
yep,
and they were separated only by a parsec, would we be able to tell, or would it look just like a don't we study the stellar velocity dispersion on a scale much bigger than
we study the stellar velocities on? Okay,
there's no evidence against that.
You can look at at least in the Milky Way, okay, we can study that our black hole fairly well, okay. Right? And if you look at Milky Way, you basically look at the radio emission from plasma around the black hole, and you ask the question, how much does that point source wander in the sky, right? Now, that's just a very, very severe constraint already on the mass of any unseen companion around it of roughly about a 30th or less, basically, of the primary black hole. So it cannot be larger than about roughly 10 to 5 solar masses because it's just enough wander. That's
so
the Milky Way.
Really, where you want to do this is in ellipticals, and I think you're right that the constraints are not great. I guess one way to do it is
right.
Multiple. The Milky Way has not undergone energy mergers. Because we have a disk, I would imagine that it hasn't, because disks are pretty fragile, and so if it had undergone a major merger like with Andromeda, we'd be an elliptical galaxy probably, or an S zero rather than. Spiral
of
a beautiful
disk.
Sorry, Andromeda
has not
undergone
merging.
Andromeda has not yet.
No, what I'm saying
is... We will, but it hasn't yet.
The question was, have we gone through a major merger? And the answer is probably not recently.
Well,
anyway,
not recently. We have a disk. I mean, if you ask the galaxy formation, I'm not sure if you are. You might be a galaxy forming. Like they say, it hasn't. Like if you look at the stellar distribution in our galaxy, and you look at the gas disk, it hasn't undergone major merger in 5 GeV.
Which is the age of the stars in this
one? So I forget exactly what the exact constraint was. Now,
just
it's not just
the
yeah.
Of ages.
Yeah, yeah. They go. Yeah, they go.
So,
uh, Yeah.
So just, I mean, presumably you may say something about it, but I guess I would expect with, you know, how many, 10 of the 11 galaxies out there,
yeah,
there should be some galaxies where we do see close binaries, because they haven't yet, I mean, they're in the process of crossing
right.
this divide,
yeah.
right? So what's the statistical, like, what fraction do we expect,
unless
this happens?
That is an outstanding question, and I'll return to that point
okay.
a little bit. That is an absolutely outstanding question. Yeah.
But I think there is maybe an obvious point here that for the black holes to be as big as they are,
yep.
I mean, they should merge, right?
No, there's no need for them to merge.
You don't know what you could do by
infall. They probably get most of the masters. Yeah, but I mean, you have 1,000 pieces that made Milky Way. If each of them had their own black holes, then you should have 1,000 black holes roaming around in the center of Milky Way. So they should. I mean, to make
well,
it
so there,
it's worse. So
yes,
it's
not clear where. So at some point, it's not. So when we talk about, when I say that at the center of all these galaxies is a black hole, people have pushed that down to basically something like 10 to 5-ish solar masses or
yes.
so. Right. So it's not clear. There is a point at which below which you don't expect to see too many black holes. Right. This
so,
is.
But even that's the limit. If it's 10^4 solar mass, there were lots of 10^4 solar mass little guys that made up
right.
merged and made big Milky Way.
Yes.
They may not be down at the nucleus right now. They could be, you know, they could be running around the Milky Way and not.
Mm-hmm.
The nucleus.
Yeah. So for those guys, there's insufficient dynamical friction. But they don't have.
It
take too long for that to happen.
I mean, for these close, I'm assuming million solar mass or up black holes that would be close together, right? I'm not assuming 10^4.
Right. Yeah.
I'm assuming 10^6, 10^7. I mean, I thought that's what was.
Yeah.
Being
so no,
yeah.
That no, that's a good question.
Yeah.
I'll talk about that in a second.
But little guys.
Yeah.
Little guys could be running around all
right.
over. Okay. So let's put it on. Is there last parsec problem? Because the obvious solution would be, okay, maybe they never merge. So then there is no problem. So you have all these.
But then you would expect to see you would expect to see perhaps like binary AGN, a close separation, and we don't see any evidence for binary AGN close separation. That is clear, basically. There is claims in literature that people do see binary AGN a close separation, like of order proxy or so, but those are very, very iffy results.
You see
two line systems, and then the problem is that, like, when you ask, like, okay, so how many two line systems do you see? You see a lot, okay, and then you ask, okay, well, can it be due to binaries, black holes, right? And the answer seems to be no, because those two lines never change, right? If you have two lines, so you see some.
Scales.
Hmm?
The orbit time scales are pretty long.
Well, the spectral resolution is pretty high as well. So, I mean, like, you just wait like a year or 10 years or so, and then you look again, and you just see some acceleration in those lines. And as far as I know, no one has seen any evidence for any acceleration of any of these lines.
So, what is the interpretation?
So, there are no systems, so-called double line emitters, basically. Where you see two lines, right?
But
and
those are
separate.
Supposedly different sizes of the disk. Right?
Different sizes of the disk, yeah.
So that's not the same thing.
Well, yeah, but like the thing is that you see two lines which are separated by velocities of a few thousand kilometers a second,
mm-hmm.
right? And so there's only two ways of interpreting. One is that like these two systems are due to two binary black holes that are orbiting each other, or these two lines are due to basically spatial distribution of gas clouds on the disk.
Lauer and Borison just published one where they argue that one has a broad line region, one has a narrow
line
region.
Right.
Like they have different velocities.
Yes.
They interpreted that as being a binary black hole
right.
ejection.
Right.
Yeah.
How big are these black holes?
It's interesting, but it's not.
But
binary ejection. Are these like million solar mass things?
Well, these are probably billion solar.
Billion.
Giant.
Yeah.
I don't
yeah.
know
what that
yeah.
number is. So in fact, the Lauer result. Okay. So they use SDSS to look for it because that's the way you get large samples. So they looked at SDSS, right? And they said, okay, we found this thing, right? So then someone did follow up. All right, so I was at Berkeley at the time when they did a follow-up, okay? And when you do the follow-up, basically, you cover stuff which is, I think, bluer, all right, than SDSS. No, redder than SDSS. And all of a sudden, you basically see additional H-alpha emission, right? And if you look at that line profile, that looks exactly like a double-line emitter, All right. And so, in fact, Lauer and Borisson looked again at this particular object, right? And one of the predictions was that basically what I said was that they expected to see basically they expected to see the lines to basically change on the order of year time scale. So they looked a year later, didn't change, right? So I mean, either it was a chance coincidence, basically, that like when we saw it, it was the accelerate they were exactly not pointing us toward you, so the acceleration is very, very small in the line of sight direction, mm-hmm. or basically the original interpretation is just wrong. It's a double line system. Yeah. Okay, so how do you solve this last parsec problem? Okay, well, there in order to solve this last parsec problem is the same question basically. How do you actually get these things to merge in the first place? Right? If I don't have enough mass in the center, basically, if I don't have enough mass and stars in the center of the thing, they have to bring of order maybe one or a few times the mass of the black hole in a time it takes less than the age of the universe, basically. So if I clear stuff out, okay, I better bring some stuff back in, basically, in order to have the black holes basically clear out again. And there are two classes of solutions to this problem, basically, right? So the first class is that, well, the reason why I have these guys stall is that I don't have enough stars in the center, so okay, I'll just bring in more stars, right? And there are ways of doing that. So one is that the galactic potential is not exactly symmetric, right? It may be triaxial, maybe look more like a football. And in that case, what happens is if you put a point mass in the center of a triaxial potential, there are a certain number of stars which are basically going to be on chaotic orbits, right? So what that means is that they will fill their phase space much more quickly, which is basically on order of dynamic time, they're going to basically explore much of their phase space, right? And because they're on chaotic orbits, some of this phase space is going to pass very close to the central supermassive black holes, and then they'll get thrown out, right? And so basically, the fraction that you need, that needs to be in chaotic orbit, so this is basically the hardening radii, so how far you can bring it in, basically. So the higher you go, basically, the closer you merge these two guys. If you get something of order, maybe 10% of the stars in chaotic orbits, then basically you can have these black holes merge, right? There are other. Okay, so let's see if I remember. So this is the ratio of the this is the stalling radius, okay? So that's
thousand times
a, right? And then that's centimeter axis, and then where I end up basically stopping, all right? So I need to bring. What?
A hard is basically where
the original stalling radius is, right? And that's the semi-major axis, all right? And A is basically where the current position would be, basically. So A would be a function of time, all right? And so in order for me to merge these two black holes, because the separation between where the stalling radius is, where the final parsec problem starts, and where I can get coalescence in less than Hubble time is of order 100, all right? I better get above this line, basically, in order to have these black holes merge, right? And so these lines are for different fractions of chaotic orbits. So this is 1%, 3%, 10%, I think 30%. I mean, this might be order 1, basically, okay? But anyway, if you're about maybe 10% of your stars in chaotic orbits, then basically you can have the black holes come close enough just through the scattering of stars, right, in order for it to coalesce in less than Hubble time just due to gravitational waves. So that's what this plot shows.
That's the upper graph?
So this is this is for some different models.
Oh, I see. Yeah, masses.
Different masses.
And are we talking about kind of large scale asphericity of the halo, or are we just, or do we only care?
So we're talking about the bulge of the galaxy. And in the bulge of the galaxy, you have some fraction of radial orbits, some fraction of circular orbits. And you're asking all of those stars which are in radial orbits, how many of these stars are in chaotic orbits?
So chaotic just means that they have a high probability of crossing the center. Is that right?
Chaotic orbits means that they're not regular, so they just don't go around.
But really
so they
what
have,
you need is orbits that go through the center.
You need orbits that go through the center.
So why not bars?
No, so bars are supported bars can be somewhere with regular orbits, they don't necessarily have to go exactly to the center. So if I clear out basically all the low angular momentum stuff, I have to have a certain number of stars which are on KR orbit explore that low angular momentum space again, basically.
But it's going to be hard. I mean, the bigger the mass, if you're talking about 2 10^8 or 10^9 solar mass black holes,
right,
it's going to get more and more difficult to do, right? Because you need to basically drop in 10^8 solar mass.
That's right. But like the M sigma relation, mass of the black hole, mass of the bulge relation tells you that fraction is about maybe 1 to 1,000.
That's over the whole bulge.
That's right. So that's the problem. You have to basically get some fraction of that bulge, maybe of order 1%, 0.1%, basically to come near the black hole, basically, in order to have it merge.
Sorry, but I thought this meant I need, in order to get this constraint satisfied,
yep,
I need A hard over A to be about 100,
yes,
roughly.
Right.
And according to that thing, it means I need about
10%
of the stars
in chaotic orbits.
Yep.
That's right.
So if we don't see that in galaxies, this doesn't work, basically.
Well, okay, so first of all, like you don't know what the orbits of stars and galaxies are, all right?
Okay.
Because you basically see them one point in time, right? The crossing time for
sure,
these guys is
that's true.
Even
yes,
mega years.
That's true. We don't see
all right. That. So what when I say this is basically from n-body simulations of galaxies.
But 10% in chaotic orbits.
10% chaotic
is
roughly
what we need
for this to have a chance. Yes. That's right. Okay. So that's one possibility. Basically you dump in stars for the center. Okay? And the other possibility, well, the same way that you make quasars, right? You basically dump a bunch of gas in the center, right? So one possibility is that you basically dump of order the mass of the black hole in a circumbinary gaseous disk over some period of time. And this circumbinary disk, just by tidal reactions with the two binary black holes, will remove angular momentum quite efficiently.
But that mass of the disk has to be comparable to the black hole mass, doesn't it?
Yes. Yes.
That's a lot of gas, isn't it? I mean, maybe it sounds like a lot of gas.
It is a lot of gas, but like for quasars, which are creating near Eddington, I mean, like over, let's say, 40 mega years, they will accrete their own mass in its gas.
But, all right, again, that's...
Yeah.
But, I mean, I thought for, like, those two spiral things merging,
yeah,
I mean, are they going to have enough gas in their cores to do this?
Well, okay, so the people who have done galaxy simulations would argue that you actually force a lot more gas to center than is actually needed to build these black holes.
Right.
Right.
Even more than you see in a typical nucleus today.
Yes,
that's what I would have thought.
That happens.
Yeah, that
it
does.
It happens.
Ow.
Yeah.
Well, there are these two galaxies that have a lot of gas, or several galaxies that merge can shine a lot of mass down into the center.
Yeah. Okay, but what if they merge and they don't have a lot of gas? Then this doesn't work.
Okay, then right. So then if you take two dry ellipticals and you just merge them together, it's not clear how you
get
them.
It's not going to happen.
Yes. Yeah, it's not clear.
Not by this.
Yes. Yeah.
I thought there was a third suggestion mechanism, which is just that, okay, so dynamical friction will carry the two black holes to the center and maybe 100 million years after the merger.
Yeah.
But then, you know, it's, let's say the time scale, let's say the dynamical friction peters out and there's more than a Hubble time left to merger. But then in another 4 billion years, there'll be
right.
Another merger.
Okay, so that's another one. That's a cosine mechanism, basically. So
or just this, three body, just I was just thinking, just a third body comes into the center.
Right.
4 billion years later, another galaxy merges.
Yes.
100 billion years after that, there's a third guy there.
Right.
He gets
ejected. Yes.
Just
right. So that times the binary, but if you just take three body interactions, that doesn't always tighten the binary by a factor of 100. That times binary by maybe a factor of 2. Okay. So in order for that to work, basically what you do is you set a third binary, which is inclined, and so now angular momentum only in one of the binary axes is really a conserved quantity. And so what happens is you can have oscillations in the total angular momentum of the inner binaries, okay? And because you have oscillation in total inner angular momentum in the inner binary, what happens is the pericenter can get very, very close to this to the pericenters of the two black holes can get very, very close. And so that, during those pericenter passages, you can remove a lot more angular momentum by gravitational waves.
And is the cosine timescale short relative to
Hubble? So the cosine timescale can be short relative to the Hubble timescale. the way to calculate the Kozai time scale is basically you're looking at the dynamical time of the two black holes, right? And then you got multiplied by the mass of the third binary times the ratio of the centimeter axis of the two black holes to the two black holes of this inner binary to the outer binary to the cube power, basically. So if that is not too big, then you can have something which occurs in less than a Hubble time.
That gets harder to do too, because once you've taken two big black holes and you've gotten them that close, they've already flung out their own mass and stars. So the stellar density in the core has already decreased. So
yes, that's right. But in order to have the Kozai work, you have to form a hierarchical triple in the first place. Yeah, so that third thing doesn't have to come all the way
right.
in.
So it can't be coming later. If it comes in later, it's going to
come in later. It's not going to come. Yeah. That's right.
What about dark matter? Dark matter also act for the SI diffraction? I
mean, yes, dark matter would act as dynamic diffraction, but
very weak in the center.
But there's no, there's not enough. There's not enough dark matter center.
Just out of the, how much mass is there in the accretion disk around this
point?
Very tiny.
So that's another good question.
What was the question?
The accretion disk around this black hole.
Yeah, so if you ask, to what extent does the accretion disk extend out to? So if you just take the accretion disk, you just extend it outward to infinity, you can have as much mass as you want. All right, so that's not really the right answer. The right answer is that if you take the accretion disk and extend it out, you can ask, at what point does the accretion disk start to become self-gravitating? All right? And once it becomes self-gravitating, what happens is that the accretion disk no longer is composed of gas, but basically that gas will clump up and form stars. And that happens at roughly something like 10 to the 4 Schwarzschild radii, 10 to the 5 Schwarzschild radii. Okay? And in that gas disk, inside of it, you have something like of order 10% of black hole mass in gas. So in order to basically have this disk basically grow that black hole, it has to be continuously fed from the outside over a period of many years.
Sorry, another still having dark matter again. How do we know there isn't enough?
We can measure the stellar dispersion. Stellar dispersion tells you the mass. You measure the amount of light you see. And you assume a stellar mass to light ratio, and then that matches basically
what you observe.
Okay, yeah.
So it's just and there are good empirical constraints.
Yeah, right. And the other reason is that like dark matter is collisionless, which means that it doesn't dynamically damp, right? And in order to basically get large concentrations, you have to basically release a lot of potential energy. All right. And so the only way to really do that is to have something that's dissipative. Gas can dissipate. Cool, fall toward the center, but dark matter cannot.
Okay.
All right. Thanks. All right. Man, I am like way behind schedule. All right, but anyway, so I just skipped this part. So the requirement of anyone doing any talk on gravitational wave binary black hole mergers is that they have to show a movie at some point. Okay. So this movie I got from Howard Feifel is at CETA right now. And so it's two binary black holes which are merging toward each other. And at some point you find that you form the common horizon, okay? You form a bigger black hole and it basically radiates away some gravitational waves and forms a final curved black hole, right? But however, that's not the end of the story because if you ask the question, in what direction does gravitational wave get thrown out, basically if you have non-equal mass black holes or you have spinning black holes which are slightly misaligned with each other, okay, what you end up getting is you get asymmetric emission of gravitational waves, right? Because over one period, the asymmetric emission will basically average on zero, but the entire merger history is not exactly symmetric. And so basically you end up getting a small amount of residual asymmetric emission of gravitational waves, and this leads to a kick in the black hole. This depends, of course, on mass ratio and orientation of spins, and for very, very specially aligned black hole spins, you can get kicks of up to 1,000, 4,000 kilometers per second or so. This is probably not the case in most astrophysical systems. You're probably looking at something close to maybe few hundred kilometers per second. All right. So I just leave it at that. Okay, so for each of these different stages, you see different counterparts, right? So for galaxy mergers, right, well, you see quasar pairs, you see disturbed galaxies, you see star formation, right? So that's kind of nice. This is probably the easiest thing to, this is probably the first thing that one can argue that is an electromagnetic counterpart of a binary black hole merger, really galactic merger, right? During the in-spiral phase, you might expect to see small separation binary AGN. This is another recent observation of a binary AGN system. This is the Cosmos J10043+20 from Comerford et al. And this separation is somewhat larger than the Camasso result that I showed a little earlier. This is probably like 2 or 3 kiloparsecs or so. Right? Okay, so you start seeing you see evidence for basically this in-spiral phase. Okay? Now the final parsec problem is actually interesting, and I'm gonna return to your point here, okay? We see no evidence for binary black holes. Right? Now, we already talked a little about the final parsec problem. You have to basically move of order the black hole masses toward the center of the galaxy in order to have them merge. Okay, you ask, how quickly can that be done? Okay, well, let's think about that. For quasars, all right, quasars are emitting near Eddington, okay, basically the max amount of luminosity one can get out of a gravitational system, right? In that case, the mass, the time scale it takes to basically grow two black holes that are, grow a black hole which is emitting at Eddington, right, is something about 40 mega years, right, which is also arguably roughly the time scale that quasars are on. Okay, now if I want to merge two black holes, I have the same problem. I have to basically take that same amount of mass and deposit it toward the center. Okay, which means that the time scale for mergers, for solving the final parsec problem in the gas case, is of order to quasar lifetime as well.
How do you know how long quasar lifetime?
Well, okay, so that's an assumption, basically. So you ask, like, how long are they on for, all right? And you ask, basically, how long does it take for them to grow to a certain amount, right? And you say, what's the maximum rate at which they can grow? You get 40 mega years, right? So past that point, it could be much longer than that, right? But no matter what, in order for it to basically emit at that luminosity, you have to basically dump that amount of mass there, right? So both things are tied, basically. If you see quasars, all right, they're on for some period of time. If you have two binary black holes, if you want to have them merge together, they also have to have the same problem. You have to dump the same amount of mass toward the center. So the final parsec problem and the quasar lifetime are intimately linked to each other. Right? The time scale for both are roughly the same. They're going to be tied. All right? All right?
So you also... You also just see that I think you'd like something like 2% or 10%, some fraction.
Yes.
Our AGN, which suggests that's what the duty cycle is, something like that fraction times the
AGN. The question is not clear actually what triggers these AGNs. So you have to have there's also additional assumptions when you say that, like for instance, what's the rate of galaxy mergers.
So okay. The point of that is that the quasar issue is comparable to
yes,
that.
Quasar issue is comparable. So now, going back to your point, people have looked. There are a lot of quasars in SDSS, of order about 100,000 quasars, right? And the fact that we don't see a single binary system there. So if you say that this ratio is 1:1, then you look at 10 quasars. You see maybe five binary black holes. You don't see any. You look at 100,000 of these guys, there's no evidence for binary black holes. So that's actually an interesting problem.
I'm a little confused. You're saying there is empirical evidence for quasars, but not the corresponding expected one for black holes?
For binary black holes. Because the two problems should be linked to each other.
So even though the two problems are linked, we're seeing the quasar thing the way we expect, but not that.
We're not seeing that. We should, I mean, like, if you were saying that the binary black hole lifetime and the final parsec problem are linked to each other because it's the same amount of mass.
The same mass dumping problem.
Exactly.
I'm uncomfortable with that because it could be that the time scale for them to merge is much longer than the quasar period. And so
what you get in a merger is you'll get a very brief but brilliant period where you've got a quasar.
Right.
But in the meantime, you know, the black holes are sort of doing their, or at least one of them may be doing its dance. And it's,
yeah.
So it may be long after the quasing has ended that the black holes actually reach the point.
That's possible. But the thing is that, like, if you turn, so you have to ask the question, like, if I have two black holes on it, and I turn one on, right, during that merger phase, what's the problem of turning both of them on during the merger phase? Right, is it less than 1 × 10⁵?
What do you mean by turning them on?
So what Professor McNamara was talking about is that when you have a merger, you basically drive the gas toward the center, and so that gas basically creeps onto the black hole, and that turns on a quasar, right? But you have another black hole which is close by or somewhat not too far away, basically, there's going to be some gas supply for it as well. Right, so then the question is basically, which one's on at what time? Right?
So you're going to see two quasars, but you expect to see two quasars, but if their velocity is very, very close, if the relative velocity is small, then how do you know you see two quasars or one quasar?
Well, I mean, you basically, this is the same argument. You look at basically the spectral lines
of quasars. Yeah, but these are very broad lines. So if the relative velocity, I don't know, like one parsec, what is the velocity, that rotational velocity that I expect?
So one parsec for 10⁸ solar mass black hole, I think, is about 700, 800 kilometers per second or so.
700.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the broad lines, aren't they of the same?
Broad lines are actually much larger than that. Broad lines are typically a few thousand kilometers.
Okay, so then that's the point. You're not going to see two lines. You're going to see just one big broad line.
Yeah, I mean, like it's.
But the narrow lines you might be.
But narrow lines,
narrow
lines. Farther away, don't feel
so. Yeah.
And so then you wouldn't know anything. So there could be two different quasars, and they're emitting like they're shining to this far away region, and that you cannot say whether this is one. The velocity of the narrow lines is the velocity of the thing that's far away, not.
The velocity of narrow lines is reflective of the velocity of the galaxy, which is something like a few hundred kilometers a second.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, like, yes, all right. I still find it a little hard to believe that if you look at 100,000 systems, you don't see a single one which would be indicative.
But the indicative thing is that you expect double lines.
You expect double lines. Yes, you expect double lines.
Very, very large relative velocity to see a double one. And, yeah.
That's possible. Yes.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks.
Okay. And okay, so then the final thing is getting to my meat of my talk now. It's mergers and kicks, basically, which is the regime of interest for gravitational wave astronomy. Okay, so let me think. I might just go through.
Well, we don't have to leave the room till 2:30.
Yeah. To 2:30? All right.
We can go a little bit over.
Okay, okay. So I'll try to go a little quicker, all right?
Maybe we should suppress questions.
No, it's all right. I actually quite enjoy this. So how many electromagnetic counterparts can we expect from a kick, basically? So there are two types, okay? So first you just have to say there is some gas involved in it, right? And part of it is that, okay, so the first part is that if there's a gas disk and I kick it, the gas disk is toward the inner edge of, toward near the black hole, it's actually orbiting faster than the kick velocities are, which is a few hundred kilometers per second. This gas disk can be carried as part of this basic kick black hole. This is a recoiling black hole, which gives you basically a AGM, which has a velocity, which is a centroid velocity, which is different than the main galaxy. Or if it's carried off for like a long period of time, let's say a mega year or so, it can be an off-centered AGM, basically. This basically displacement would be anywhere from 1 to 10 kiloparsecs, right? So that's one possibility that people have tried to look for and have not found any evidence for. The other possibility is that the kicks can directly affect the gas disk. Okay, so if I give a black hole a kick, the disk in the center mass frame of the entire of the black hole kick system receives a kick in the opposite direction, right? And so what happens when this happens? What happens in this case is that if you consider the gas as basically just particles in a disk, they've gone suddenly from basically perfectly circular orbits to elliptical orbits of varying eccentricity, varying ellipticity, right? And what happens is that basically these particles, after one dynamical time, will start to basically interact with each other and form spiral shocks, right, which propagate out. And the amount of luminosity in these spiral structures is actually quite substantial. It's of order the mass of the disk times the kick velocity squared, right? And if you look at the time scale which is associated with this, this is basically the dynamical time of the disk, which is anywhere of order a few years to like maybe thousands of years, right? And the luminosity can actually be quite substantial. It can be anywhere from basically 10 to the 42 to maybe about 10 to the 44 Earths per second, right?
The mass of the disk inside the self-gravity, inside the radius of which it becomes
self-gravity is of order 10% of the mass of the black hole. All right.
And it's that mass times the kick velocity squared that is
that mass times the kick velocity squared. Now, most of the mass is at large radii. And so, as a result, you have to weight one dynamo pi at the largest radius in order to get most of the luminosity out, which sets this time scale of 1,000 years. So this is kind of nice because black hole kicks are expected from mergers, right? But the strength is not clear. Okay, so that's okay. I mean, you learn something about that from looking for these particular systems, all right? This kick is probably the most promising avenue thus far from what you can detect a prompt electromagnetic counterpart could be, right? But I want to ask the question, could there be emission that precedes this merger, precedes the final merger of the two black holes? And this is my model, basically, which is the electromagnetic precursor, right? And so it's a very simple model. You have basically two gas disks. The color didn't come out quite well. But there's an inner gas disk, okay, and you imagine basically the inner gas disk was originally out to self-gravitating radii, maybe 10 to 4, 10 to 5 Schwarzschild radii. And then basically I'm going to drop a secondary supermassive black hole there. And that secondary supermassive black hole, I'm going to assume it's coplanar, and I can make an argument why it has to be coplanar. Namely that if it wasn't, tidal torques between the disk and the black hole, and the orbiting black hole, would align the black hole to the disk or the disk to the black hole, right? Okay, and as a result of having this black hole somewhere in this disk, it opens up a gap between the circumbinary outer disk, which is continually fed from gas from the outside, okay, and the inner disk, which is now insulated from the external gas supply, all right? So basically what happens is that now this outer gas disk is going to basically interact tidally with this secondary black hole and remove angular momentum from the secondary black from the black hole orbit and basically transfer the angular momentum out to basically a large radii in the disk. Okay, so just to give you a brief equation that one just needs to do, so I'll just show you this one slide on the equation. Basically the surface equation of continuity, an equation of conservation of angular momentum with two terms. One is the viscous term of viscous transport in the disk, and the second term is basically of tidal interactions between the gas disk and the binary block and the secondary black hole. And then angular momentum conservation for the secondary black hole, namely driven by basically the tidal interaction with the disk and basically gravitational wave losses. All right.
So are you assuming that the primary black hole is at rest?
The primary black hole is at rest, much more massive than secondary black hole. Secondary black hole, which in this case I'm assuming something of order 10% of the primary black hole, in order to make this approximation, basically, that I could use this simple tidal approximation. So this is basically a little movie of what happened. This is the outer gas disk, all right? And feeding outer gas disk at something like of order the Eddington rate, okay? Of course, the black hole is not emitting at Eddington rate because there's no gas there. At this inner gas disk, which initially was, let's see if I can show again. At this inner gas disk, which initially is very, very low mass and basically declines as a function of time, okay, until it reaches a certain point, right, at which gravitational waves from the secondary black hole starts to take over. And to that point, basically, you can see what happens, right? I'm basically going to try to push this tiny mass of gas in the inner disk toward the center, all right? And generate a lot of dissipation and basically just emit all that radiation at the final instant, right? To show basically what happens, right? The initial evolution is just driven by the fact that the outer gas is being fed from an external source and basically just pushing this black hole toward the center, okay? the inner gases, on the other hand, basically has a very, very rapid viscous time. So this is the evolution time of the merger time of the black hole, and this is the viscosity, the viscous time at any radii. And you can see basically for the inner gases, the viscous time is much, much smaller than the merger time. So what that means is the disk has time to viscously respond. If I push it in a little bit, I'll tightly interact with the inner gas disk, and this disk will just basically viscously respond to this new equilibrium. So it basically slowly viscously responds. It slowly viscously moves from one viscous equilibrium to another viscous equilibrium.
So the black hole's at the origin?
The black hole, there's a primary black hole at the origin. This
what
is the
I see. What sets the scale of that gap with the inner disk? Like, it's sort of.
Oh, this. Okay, so this
no,
is basically.
Not that gap, the other gap.
Oh, no. This is Schwarzschild radio.
Oh,
so this is three, basically.
All right,
three,
so that's the edge of the black hole.
That's the edge of the black hole, yeah. That's the ISCO, right.
That's the ISCO, not the
Schwarzschild. That's the ISCO, yes. The Schwarzschild radii is 2 GM of R, right? I'm assuming it's not Rossby.
Okay, so that's the ISCO.
That's the ISCO, yeah. Yeah. Okay.
So this is like an alpha disk, is that right?
Yeah, so basically, so this outer disk is an alpha disk. You can show this analytic is an alpha disk. And this inner disk is a much smaller alpha disk, much smaller.
But the viscous prescription is alpha.
Viscous description is actually a beta prescription.
Oh, okay.
All right, which means that I'm just using gas pressure, not the total pressure.
Okay, what sets that distance scale between the two?
Oh, this is just basically the viscous, where viscous transport of angular momentum is equal to tidal forcing from the secondary black hole. Right, so it's the balance of torque. So this is basically where torques are
for that.
Yeah. Okay, so then what happens eventually is that the merger time gets to be short, because at this point what happens is that the secondary black hole is dominated by gravitational wave losses, right? And now the merger time is somewhere down here. And you see basically the viscous time of this inner gas disk is much, much longer than the merger time. So at this point, it no longer looks like an alpha disk. You can see alpha disks normally have a slope which is falling outward. This is a slope which is falling inward, right? And so what happens is that now this disk, the evolution of this disk from now on, is no longer dominated by viscosity, but dominated totally by tidal torques, all right? And the rate at which this inner gas disk will evolve now just depends on the gravitational wave time scale of the secondary black hole. Right.
So in this case, the disk's mass is comparable to the secondary black hole's mass, or it's the same.
So this outer disk mass is comparable to the secondary black hole mass. The right way of saying it is that the total amount of angular momentum, right, because this goes from basically 2 R, like 100 RG down to about 10 to 5 R, total amount of angular momentum in the outer disk is equal to the angular momentum that was lost through the inner disk. Okay. All right. Now, this inner disk, however, is always much less massive than either of these two systems, basically.
Is the inner disk is only losing mass into the black hole?
The inner disk can only move toward the inner black hole, and only loses mass initially just through viscous accretion. But at this point, it's no longer driven by viscosity.
It's essentially constant in mass.
It's essentially, now at this point, it's constant in mass. Yes, and now it's just basically going, just that mass is going to be constant to smaller and smaller radii, right? Just driven by tides, okay? And you see this, again, in this plot right here, basically at this point, the evolution outer disk, because the viscous time is really long compared to the merger time now, this outer disk is frozen, right? And the inner disk is just driven by tides, and just due to tidal dissipation, this inner disk is going to have a huge luminosity, all right, just right before the merger of the two black holes, okay? And you can show, we can show that basically all these answers here. So this is the mass of the inner disk, this line right here, all right? Okay, for two different mass inflow rates. I think this is Eddington, and I think this is for like about a tenth of Eddington or something like that, all right? And you can see basically the mass of the inner disk basically stays constant, all right, until it finally gets forced into the inner black hole. Right?
Is this based on simulation of the equation you showed us?
Yes, this is based on the numeric integration of the equation. Yes, that's right. That's right.
So you have different things, but here. So you said the solid line.
So the solid. So this solid line is just this solid line here is just the luminosity, right? So initially,
okay.
All you see is the luminosity from the arrow disk.
But the other lines are the.
And this line right here is the mass of the inner disk. Okay. So initially, it's just constant, right? Because I'm well past the point where viscous evolution can dominate. It's constant, and then basically at the very end. Right when I have the brightest part of my luminosity, I just force that energy into the primary black hole.
It brightens by a factor of 30 or something?
So yeah, it grows by a factor of 30. Now you notice that there's a slope here, which is t to the minus 5 fourths, right? That slope is t minus, so it's the time before merger, grows as t to the minus 5 fourths. And the reason for that is that the merger time, right, scales like r to the fourth power, all right? But the luminosity goes like 1 over r, right? So if you actually combine these things, the luminosity goes like 1 over r times the merger time, assuming that the gas, the inner gas, this is constant, right? Times the inverse of the merger time. So you end up getting basically t merged to the minus 5 fourths in this case as a result. So this is a very characteristic signature of this kind of merger. Now the other thing to note is that the characteristic time scale for this particular object, a 10 to the 7th solar mass black hole, is of order a day or so. So one day before the merger, all right, if you have the inner gas disk, which is just basically has been quietly sitting there for like eons, okay, this inner gas disk basically gets forced into the central supermassive black hole on a day time scale, and you end up getting a luminosity of order few by 10 to the 44 ergs per second.
And what's the spectrum?
So the spectrum is quite hard, okay? So basically, what's it? 10 to the it's basically something in this in UV soft X-rays, basically. All right. And so these are for different mass ratio of black holes. This is 1 to 10, this is 1 to 3. Now this might be a little confusing. Why is 1 to 3 lower in luminosity than 1 to 10? And that's simply because that the inner gas, this mass is quite a bit lower. The tidal gap is a little bit bigger than 1 to 3. And as a result of that tidal gap being a little bigger, there's just less mass in the force in a sufficiently short time.
When is this? At what time is this spectrum?
This is at peak.
This is at
this peak right here. Right. Okay.
And then as the mass ratio gets so low that the outer black hole is smaller than the mass in the inner disk, then it goes down again?
If the mass of
so the luminosity doesn't just keep going up as the mass ratio gets smaller. It cuts off when the mass of the outer black hole is equal to the.
Oh, right. So when the mass of the outer black hole is equal to the mass of the inner black hole, none of this approximation holds anymore. In fact, 1 to 10 is already kind of iffy. But and 1 to 3 is definitely iffy. Because I made the assumption that the.
I mean, what's the small mass ratio cutoff? It's when the disk, when the small black hole is equal to the mass of the inner disk.
No. So the I'm not sure I understand.
You're saying the luminosity of the electromagnetic signature goes up as you increase the mass ratio.
So the limit on that is I haven't actually thought about the limit on that.
Isn't it true that one of the approximations is that you were saying the inner disk is small in mass?
The inner disk is always small. The inner disk is always small to the mass of the black hole, of the two, any of the two black holes and the outer disk, right? It's always small. So in fact, when you look at this mass, you can see it's 10 to the minus 3 solar masses. It's the mass of Jupiter, all right? And the only reason why I get this bright bump is that I'm forcing the mass of Jupiter in a one-day time scale, which turns out to be roughly the Eddington luminosity in that case, right? That's the only reason why. So it's always very small, okay? So if you're asking, what's the max amount of luminosity you can have in this tidally forced case for the different mass ratios? I actually don't know that answer. I haven't thought about that. Nayesh, you had a question?
No, I just wanted to go to see the
next
book.
Okay.
Sorry, I didn't
yeah. Make it. Yes. So this is just the luminosity of this thing. You see, basically, the inner disk is basically bright in the soft X-rays, about 0.1 keV. And this gap in the spectrum right here is just due to the fact that the outer gas disk, this luminosity right here just comes from the outer gas disk, and there's basically no emission between the outer gas disk and the inner ring where this stuff is being tidally forced inward. Okay. All right. So, okay, I'm going to close it now, right? These electromagnetic precursors will tell you something about the presence of inner accretion disks, so it tells you about accretion physics, all right? Now, I assume that the inner accretion disk has no additional mass source, right? Any additional mass source toward the inner accretion disk will actually make the maximum luminosity quite a bit bigger. Namely, that if it's not one Jupiter mass, let's say it's like a few Jupiter mass or a tenth of a solar mass, that luminosity could be significantly higher than Eddington in that case, right? The tidal forcing of this inner disk, because of the fact that you have a secondary black hole there, basically forcing this guy, right, is very similar to a system in astrophysics known as superhumping systems, where you have two stars or a white dwarf and a low mass companion orbiting each other with an accretion disk around the white dwarf. And in that case, what happens is that people have seen basically the changing eccentricity of the accretion disk, okay, at the period of the binary, right? So something similar could happen for black holes as well. You have to basically the accretion disk becomes ellipsoidal in that case, or elliptical in that case. And as the accretion disk basically moves around at the frequency of the binary, you basically would expect to get a periodic signal from that, and that you can and unambiguously identify that with a Lisa source, right? Because you have the period. Okay? And finally, the rising light curve, T merged in minus 5 fourths, can be directly identified as a result of tidal forcing, right? Because all this just comes from basically the fact that gravitational waves is driving systems. Okay, well, I'm not going to ask about audio. There are some unanswered questions, but I'm not going to answer them. All right, so toward the future, I mean, like, there are one thing is just to do better numerical computations. There are other possibilities for electromagnetic counterparts, which I haven't touched on at all. And much work remains to be done on these optical X-ray counterparts. All right. There is some additional work that one can think about in terms of radio counterparts, and this is something that Luis is clearly thinking about. Basically, when you have plasma around two binary black holes, maybe they can excite basically a radio source nearby, and that would be another way of studying these particular systems. So I'll just close with these conclusions, and I'll let you guys go.